gentlemen, welcome to the most electrifying, must-listen-to podcast in sports entertainment. Welcome to FFC. I am your host, Damian Ellinghouse, accompanied as always by good friend and lover of things whose membership is for life, Ryan Doyle.
How are you, sir?
Well, Ryan, how could I not be just the best? How could I not be just the best? We live in glorious times where hundreds of thousands of people have died due to a deadly virus, and the country we live in is incapable of managing it. But inside the ruins, almost like playing Fallout 3, deep in beneath all the glitches and the errors, there are jewels in this nuclear Holocaust wasteland that we live in. And that is because a very special episode tonight. No time for dillying, nor time for dallying, Ryan. Not today, Bubby.
What about diddle time?
Is that what you want to commit with? You want to commit to diddle time?
No.
We can't dilly, no. We can dally, but we can diddle? That's what you want out of this?
We're really following up a great episode last week with some nonchalant.
Yeah, this is great. We'll have conversations about social justice and activism, and we'll follow it up with diddling. Great, great stuff. Really putting the filthy back in filthy fucking casuals. So, we jump.
Dandy time?
Dandying is better. We could do dandy.
Okay.
Dandy. Why didn't you lead off with dandy?
We can dandy up in this bitch. I don't know, man. You know where my brain goes?
Why did it go to diddle? Very troubling, Ryan. It's true what Freud says. Okay.
Wait, hold on.
No,
let's start this
over.
We're
gonna
sound like a molester.
We're gonna go straight into it. No do-overs, no take backs. Okay. So, Ryan, what are you consuming tonight?
So over the weekend, I decided to take a little stop on down to Oceanside, New York. Listeners of the program will very much know what I'm referring to, and that's, of course, it's HQ at this point, Barrier Brewery. Been there enough times. You guys heard me multiple times hyping up their beer, and they were running a special where if you bought a case, you could flip a coin and get a free 4-pack.
Did you win?
Papa loaded up on 6 different beers, and it came time to flip the coin, and I did not win.
Ah, well.
And they were just like, oh, you lost. I'm like,
well, thanks.
Oh, cool.
Anticlimactic. So, everything was $12, though. Everything was $12, so that's a lot of money
everything
saved.
$12? Yeah. No, that was completely fine. I will never turn down a case of Barrier Beer. But I got a lot of good selections, and the one I'm drinking tonight is the Imposter, which is their Pilsner, and not Papa's Pilsner, though. This one has a very effervescent aftertaste to it.
Oh, very bubbly.
And, you know, it's not like, yes, exactly. And it's not like, you know, standard Pilsners where it's like, you know, the ones that you would steal out of your dad's refrigerator. No, this one's a good one. And it clocks in at 5.0 ABV, and it's delicious.
I really miss Barrier a lot. I hope I can go back there soon. I bought like a 4-pack of Money the other day just to remember what it tasted like. And you know, it's funny because Money is their flagship IPA, and I never get it when I'm there. I always get something else. But
yeah, that's funny. I completely agree. That's like the same. I've had it so many times, but like, you know, it's just like, how could you not get a case and not get Money, you know?
But taking a break for this long and like explicitly not getting it to try their other stuff to then get a 4-pack of it when I open it up, I was like, boy, this really is one of the best fucking IPAs on the market. So good for you supporting local business. I have something that is not supporting local business, but it is, you know, it's not Anheuser-Busch, so don't fucking get mad at me. It is another selection of the Pastryarchy by Duclaw Brewing, and this time we've got a Mexican hot chocolate brown ale. Now, this bad boy's clocking in at 7%. And as per the label, Hot chocolate has evolved as it's been adopted all over the world. This brown ale is a nod to an early iteration of a traditional favorite originating in Mexico, made with cinnamon spice, deep chocolate, and lactose. Oh, and drink it cold. The hot refers to the spice, not the temp. Imagine some poor sap out there. It's like, I gotta microwave the stout first. It's hot. It's hot chocolate.
Do you dad someone wouldn't do that?
No, they'd probably keep it in the can too. Fuck this country. This one's good. I've already had it. I had it the other day. It's a little nightcap. So,
shout outs to Dewclaw, man. They've been throwing some haymakers this past year. They do not give a fuck.
No, they've got some interesting shit. I tried like a peppermint candy cane brown ale of theirs as well. It was like minty. I had like a Belgian waffle cone stout or some shit.
Have you had unicorn farts?
Have I had unicorn farts? I don't know. I don't. Maybe. I can't. I don't
from their
know.
Sour Me series. I feel like that's like their most known beer at this point.
I'd buy that. So we grab, we crack. Gotta get it in your. There we go.
Oh.
Yep, that went everywhere.
Overload. Yep, me too. Okay.
Mine's brown too. And we sip.
Oh yeah.
What's fun about this one is it's got a little bit of kick in the back of the throat there. It's not quite spicy, but it's like just a little bit of a kick. It's very nice.
Yeah, spicy beers are a delicate balance. You don't want to like assault your tongue. I had a habanero beer before, and it was exactly what I think it was. I was like, dude, that sounds terrible, and it was pretty bad. But then I had another habanero beer from Collector's Brewery in Bayshore. Friends of the program, Diana Yoga, it was their collaboration.
Oh, cool.
And it was much better because it was like, they made it more hidden within the beer. They didn't make it like the front part of the beer itself. And, you know, anytime you go that route, just like, don't make it too much.
Diani also had a collaboration with Moontooth. They made some fresh yoga pants based off off the song, right? Not the album.
It was based off Queen Wolf, and then they have one from Crux, the design. Yeah, yeah. I'm actually wearing one of their shirts right now.
Oh, cool.
It's a collaboration with Damien Eccles.
Hey, I like that name.
And it goes to his project, which rehabilitates prisoners who were wrongfully imprisoned.
Oh, cool. And a good thing to support as well. All right. So we are not going to spend a whole ton of time talking about current events because we're going to spend a lot of time talking about current events in our main segment. Real quick, just to breeze through the Royal Rumble. Overall, pretty decent pay-per-view. The Women's Rumble was great. I found it personally to be, I think, a lot better than the Men's Rumble. Maybe not a lot better, but like the Men's Rumble lacked that normal oomph for obvious reasons. But the Women's Rumble, I really felt like hit all the marks that you're looking for. Some surprise entrances, some great spots, really great stuff. And of course, who won, Ryan? Who won that Royal Rumble?
Est, baby.
The EST of WWE, Bianca Belair, the EST of FFC's hearts. So happy, so pleased. It would have been nice.
Yeah, what a great finish overall. I mean, the pace on the women's was so much better than the men's.
It was. It really was. And that last three with Charlotte, Rhea, and Bianca, and then Bianca getting Charlotte back for last year, and then like her and Rhea having that whole great interaction at the end. Really great stuff. I kind of wish Bianca could have gotten a few more eliminations. It kind of felt like a big part of that match she was kind of surviving, which of course when you enter that early in, I mean, she was what, the third entrant overall, right?
Right.
So like that's a long time to survive. So it's, you know, that's, it's a small nitpick, but thankfully it is clear that the organization values her, and I'm really hoping that she gets a Mania win, you know, either off of Asuka or Sasha. I think that Asuka's definitely held the belt for a long time, and so like losing it to someone as credible as Bianca would be great, but Bianca and Sasha having a banger of a match and then having the younger generation go over for Sasha, you know, and having Bianca Belair get like a signature win would be really great. So we'll see.
You know, I think making her known at this point is more important than whether or not she gets a win. Obviously, I would love that. But, you know, just thinking realistically.
It's fair.
But they swerved us three times in that match, which is good. It was when Alexa, like, all the lights started to go out, and then Rhea was like, no, 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 you're not doing that. Get the fuck out of here.
It really made me think of the most recent arc of Dragon Ball Super when, like, there's an enemy powering up in the tournament, and then Android 17 blasts him, and everyone's like, why did you stop them from transforming? And he was like, am I supposed to wait for them? Why would I wait? It's like, it's a great moment of just a wrestler in kayfabe being smart enough to be like, no, we're not. No stupid lights go out shit. Goodbye. Go away. Love it.
And with Charlotte too, because like, I'm sure you had the same feeling as me that
here
when you saw
we
Charlotte
go.
There. Yep,
here
exactly.
Here we go.
But no, they both eliminated her, and they did it well. They did everything well. So yeah. I'm very happy with the result.
And you had a couple of pretty surprising comebacks in that match. It's funny, literally earlier in that day, for whatever reason, I was talking about Tori Wilson. Just like randomly talking about her, and so like for her to show up was extremely fucking funny. And then like you got a couple of, you know, Jillian Hall, that whole thing with Billy Kay was I thought cute. I thought that was funny.
Not who I'm clamoring for, but if you need a surprise,
hey, what,
sure.
Those are always fun. You like those. Victoria, big surprise, I'm sure, for a lot of people.
That was cool, man. I always dug her. You know, she was kind of like in a non-respected era, but she always kicked ass.
Yeah.
So, and she looks like she could still kick ass, honestly.
And I was personally really, I was pretty happy to see Alicia Fox, who has definitely had her share of struggles over the past couple of years, so... Nice to see her back. Feels like she's just fucking around forever. And, you know, nice to see
her. I forgot about that. Yeah, it's good to see that, you know, she got her stuff together. So
overall solid. And I don't know. None of the other matches are super worth talking about. The women's tag match, Nia Jax and Shayna won again. And Drew beat Goldberg, which is literally the only thing that I want to talk about with that match, is just that Drew won and we hopefully move on. Sasha and Carmella had a... I'm sorry, you had a thought on Drew?
But they did the right thing. I was going to mention the KO Roman match, but we could talk about...
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, that's fair.
Let's talk about the Carmella-Sasha match first.
And just real quick, it was good. Yeah. I think that Carmella has really improved leaps and bounds in the ring over the last... Like, since her SmackDown Women's run as champion. Right decision. I hope this feud is now officially over. We can move past it. And you're right. The Roman Kevin Owens match was very, very good. That botch with the handcuffs. Honestly, didn't even feel that weird in the moment of watching, but
in
context, it's weird.
I didn't have a problem with that. I had a problem with the submission at the end.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's like,
yeah.
You're going to go through all that trouble for a submission. You know? I mean, I think we had a good understanding that KO wasn't going to win here, but at the same time, it's like, it's a little lazy.
No,
I don't know.
Agreed.
Maybe they had an audible that we don't know about because of the keys. Stupid Paul Heyman.
That's what it was. Yeah, KO was like overselling the low blow because he needed to give him time to like figure that out. And then,
so I mean, what are you going to do? That shit happens, especially in a non-DQ match.
Yeah, is what it is. And then the men's rumble, like, I thought it was fine. You know, it was unspectacular. You know. Shinsuke and Cesaro both really did not have anything resembling the rumble I was hoping they would have.
Yeah, we were. Neither did Big E.
Neither did Big E. No, neither did Big E. He did.
I was expecting Edge to win, but I wasn't expecting any surprise name at the end.
But you know what? Actually, digging through the stats, though, Big E did have a pretty good. Outside of Edge and Randy Orton obviously wasn't around for like almost any of the match actually. Big E was in it the longest at almost 30 minutes, and he tied for the most eliminations at 4. So, but I think it kind of speaks to the fact that, like, it just, it didn't feel that big outside of, you know, him getting rid of Mustafa Ali.
Right. And, you know, if they're going to make it a point to keep him in the match for so long, they have to give him, like, some resilience in the match, you know?
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
If there's one thing, unfortunately, that's missing, it's Pat Patterson. And I think he really got a good understanding of, like, when to send out particular wrestlers, yep. You know? Let's overload the ring with heels, and here comes the babyface. Obviously, the biggest element missing is the crowd itself, but... you know, people only pay attention to two things in the Rumble, whether or not you last the longest or if you get that many eliminations.
Yeah, 100%.
And honestly, you can get 11 eliminations, but if you last 2 minutes, like, it's not going to be worth it.
Who cares? And, like, and I think that's a great point, because, like, someone like Cesaro shouldn't be coming in 28th. Someone like Cesaro, you want an Iron Man type of situation.
Exactly. 100%. I mean, it's a small gripe, obviously.
Yeah,
you know,
it's not the worst. It's just, I think that these are, you know, gripes to have.
But doing it with Edge was cool.
Yeah, and I mean, who got the surprise entrant right, Ryan? Was it I? I believe it was I that said that the special entrant would spit in the face of those who were uncool, and that a certain daddy would return. 2-4-2. 2-4-2. Carlito,
you're right,
looked fucking great also.
Dude, oh my God.
Looking strapped up. My goodness.
My man got the call from Triple H and fucking went to town.
Seth was in the match for less than 10 minutes, got 3 eliminations, and, you know, cool to see him back. And then, of course, Hurricane Helms showing up on AEW and WWE. Very cool.
Nice.
And Christian, fucking Christian. And Christian, like, being in it, doing things. And,
dude, you
very
want to
cool.
All right, so let me, I'll take back what I said. My bad. There was a fucking surprise at the end. I'm an idiot. Christian did the last Final Four.
Yeah, yeah.
Doing work. That was fucking good. And it looks like he didn't miss a step.
No, he really, like, looks as good as ever. And
it would have been cool if Gangrel came out.
That would have been cool. But it looks like he may actually be sticking around. So
Christian?
Yeah, they
maybe down with that, why not?
The way that they framed it, like, was like, hey, is this the end for Captain Charisma? It seems like he had a lot left in the tank, so, like, I have a feeling that he will be around. And yeah, and of course Edge coming in number one and winning. You know, are there other people that could have used that rub? Yeah, for sure. But of all the, like, older guys that could win a Rumble, Edge is, like, kind of the one I feel like I'm going to have the least gripes about. You know, like, sure,
right,
it could have been a younger talent, but, you know, it also feels fine, right?
Yeah, we talked about it last week. You know, they rarely pull out surprises, and that's fine. I think if the last year didn't play out the way it did with Edge, we would have a different story here.
Yes.
But, you know, it's cool. I'm down with it. Now they have 3 people who went the distance. And now they don't have to do the awkward 2 people have gone the distance in the Royal Rumble, and Shawn Michaels is one of them. Like, obviously, yeah, we know who the other name is.
No, we don't.
But now they can comfortably mention Edge and Shawn Michaels and not have to.
Who's the other name, Ryan? I didn't know there was a third person. Who is it? It's Shawn Michaels, Edge, and who?
Crispy Chicken.
Oh, Crispy Chicken. It's great. Love him.
Of course.
Love them. Yeah. So, you know, overall, it was fun. No massive complaints. Feels like a pay-per-view that did what it set out to do, and that's A-okay sometimes, you know. Don't feel like they knocked it out of the park. Don't feel like it was awful. Bianca Belair and Edge as your winners doesn't bother me a whole ton. And we're on the road to WrestleMania, you know, we pointed the sign, so whatever.
We have plenty of time
That's not what we're here for.
Box ourselves
it's
in.
Not here. That's not what we're here for, Ryan. Because
we're not here for the Daily Raw coverage.
We're not here for the Daily Raw coverage. You can go watch Raw Talk. No, because last week, Bash at the Beach, AEW, some fun matches, some good stuff, right? Last match, 6-man between Kenny Omega and the Good Brothers versus Jon Moxley, Rey Fénix, and Pac. Very strange get together, but was here for it. Lumberjack match between Eddie Kingston and Lance Archer. Solid. Main event was real good. And then, of course, you know, at the end, we got to start beating down. Moxley. And then Lance Archer comes out for a save. And that's kind of interesting because Lance Archer and Moxley have beef in Japan. So that was definitely interesting. But hey, enemy of my enemy. But then, you know, Kenny Omega and the Good Brothers, they do their thing, you know, and they come back out. And then Moxley turns the pages and looks like he's getting ready to hit Kenny again. And then somebody comes out and attacks Moxley. Who is it? He put him on his shoulders, Ryan. Was it John Cena?
Who is it? Who is it? It's Bobby Lashley, by God!
It was motherfucking Kenta! Motherfucking Kenta! Number one contender for the IWGP United States Champion, member of Bullet Club, the real Bullet Club, comes out and pays back Moxley for showing up on New Japan Strong and attacking him. And then looks at Kenny Omega and shakes his head in disgust and walks away. Kenny Omega chases after him and goes, "Hey, Brother Switchblade didn't tell me to expect any guests. Put it here. Welcome to the American Club." Goes for the two sweet. Kenta goes, "Ha ha ha, shut the fuck up. I'm just here for Moxley," which, by the way, Kenta, top tier shit talker. So good. He's really such a good shit talker.
Especially because I guess you don't expect it from him.
No, his English is phenomenal. It really is. And like, he honed that during his time in NXT. And all of a sudden, like that, Ryan, the Forbidden Door blown off its fucking hinges. The next night, they announce Kenta and Kenny Omega versus Jon Moxley and Lance Archer. Kenta there with the briefcase, Moxley with the belt in it, being called the United States Champion for the first time ever. Bullet Club being said on the air, "We got a partnership, my friend." And wow. Wow.
Yeah, you know, if we recorded this episode last Thursday, I think we would have speculated to the moon. Right now, this is just for the IWGP US heavyweight belt to get us some time so people don't forget about it. Mm-hmm. Kenta lives in Florida already.
Yes.
So he can't go to Japan. Moxley can't go to Japan on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. So regardless of what it is, the door has been open. New Japan is using one of their guys on AEW. I can't see a scenario where the relationship doesn't continue after this. It can only lead to good things. Unless Tony Khan like spits in the face of like the New Japan front office for no reason.
Again, no, you know, we will focus on the program at hand, right? And we there's a lot of speculation that we're going to do in just a minute here in our main segment. But it is, you know, Dave Meltzer reported that the pandemic had a lot to do with it. The leadership had a lot to do with it. And that's because they didn't really want to strip Jon Moxley of the belt like they did the first time. They could have at any point if they wanted to. And instead, they had him hold the belt because they wanted Moxley back. And it looks like this was the way to get that relationship fixed, was Jon Moxley, who once again proves to be one of the most valuable assets in wrestling, really in recent memory. And look, you could probably say that like AEW and New Japan working together was like kind of inevitable. It felt inevitable in a lot of ways. But the reality is that the front office and the Elite were not on good terms when they left. The Elite felt that they were not given contracts worthy of what they brought to the table. New Japan felt like they built the Elite for all intents and purposes into the worldwide phenomenon that it was. And so there was a lot of bad blood. But after Harold Mage left, things change, you know, guards are subject to change. And here we are, we're going to focus on the program. You know, like you said, the two are going to go at it. I believe it is like February 23rd. And I believe the match has already been taped, but the bottom line is Kenta's going to be on AEW. Jon Moxley and Kenta officially that walk through the gates. And there's quite a few people that live in Florida. A lot of Bullet Club lives in Florida. You could very easily get Jay White on there once he's done with his tour in Japan. So a lot of it's just, wow, what can you say? New Japan, Impact, and AEW all in the same fucking ring. And you had an NWA women's match the same night. I mean, wow, fuck me.
Huh? Yeah, brother. You're getting that big pop-up 10 for the territories again. Exactly what we covered over the summer.
It's a beautiful
thing. In that big hood, baby.
It's a beautiful, beautiful thing. February 26th is the is the championship match at New Beginning USA. That's what it is. Yeah, no, it's...
Yeah, is AEW doing a pay-per-view akin to Revolution?
They're doing Revolution, but they're doing it a little later on. I think they're doing it in March, if memory serves. New Japan also has New Beginning in Hiroshima coming up on February 10th and 11th. I'm not going to do like a full review of it, but you're going to see Hiromu Takahashi versus Sho for the IWGP Junior Heavyweight Championship. You're going to see G.O.D., Tamatanga, and Tangaloa versus Dangerous Techers, Taichi, and Zack Sabre Jr. in a rematch for the IWGP Heavyweight Tag Championship. That's on night one. And then night two, the main event is going to be Kota Ibushi versus Sonata for the IWGP Double Championships. The Never Six Man will be on the line for the first time in a couple of months. Tomohiro Ishii, Goto, and Yoshihashi, the champions, versus Tamatanga, Tangaloa, and Jay White, who has recently returned. So there's those shows should be a lot of fun, if for nothing else, for Takahashi and Sho and Dangerous Techers and G.O.D.
Do these shows historically have something play out within them, or is it akin to like Great Balls of Fire? Is it just like a throwaway pay-per-view, or is it like, do they use this as like a vehicle for storylines?
They definitely use it as a vehicle, because like it's the New Beginning tour and it's lasted from January to now, so it
okay,
like
so it's
it,
a culmination,
it carries, it's like kind of, it's the first feuds that have happened of the new year. Okay. So you could be in for some surprises, but you know, just looking at it, like I'd be pretty fucking shocked if Hiromu drops to Sho, but it'll probably be a great match. Dangerous Techers and G.O.D. is a little more up in the air, where I'm not really sure. Obviously, there's no fucking chance in hell Kota Ibushi drops to Sonata, but it should be a good match. And then the Never, I am actually interested to see what happens for the six-man match, because Chaos has held that for a while, and it'd be interesting to see if G.O.D. retains the tag championships and then also becomes six-man champions. I think the Bucks recently did that, so that'd be interesting. But that's I'll talk about it next time, because what we're really here to talk about is, like we said, this is a massive, massive thing that has happened. It really can't be overstated. There are a lot of people that feel like partnership between New Japan and AEW is kind of a thing that only, you know, real hardcore fans are going to get. But I don't really think that's true. I think that the reality is that casual fans, the way that you consider it, don't really exist like that. Like, if you don't give a shit about wrestling, you don't give a shit about wrestling at all. But this, I think, puts a lot of eyes on you, because WWE just doesn't do shit like this. So it's a big fucking deal. Nobody's done shit like this. Ring of Honor is the last. I mean, Impact did it, but Impact was not like it. It wasn't the same level, right? Like, they popped higher numbers, but they were not at the same level as AEW. Do you feel like that's fair to say? At their peak?
Yes. I would also argue, though, that New Japan wasn't at the level that they were today. So, everybody will look at that initial run and blame TNA, and they wholeheartedly deserve all the credit for fucking that up. But at the same time, New Japan wasn't on the level as it was today.
That is 100% accurate. That was before the rise of Tana. That was when Enokiism was at its strongest. You just had Brock Lesnar as champion. That's a great point. But now
it would be more laughable, and people would be more furious at TNA if they, you know, mishandled like Okada at his peak. But like at the same time, it's just, you know,
it wasn't. Yeah. It was
a dead period.
No, 100%. So this past episode of Dynamite saw perhaps the most shocking crossover of the last few decades in Kenta's debut in AEW, right? As we said, this officially cements a partnership between New Japan and the promotion that started as a direct result of some of the most important players on the New Japan roster leaving to forge their own path in AEW. Now, the change in management, as we mentioned, the pandemic, a desire to keep John Moxley, Harold Mays stepping down, those are all the common causes, as far as we can see, behind the thawing of relationships between them. But at the center of it all, right, is the faction that helped raise New Japan to more global heights, Bullet Club. Now, this all, of course, goes even further back to AEW and Impact's crossover, when Kenny Omega reunited with the Good Brothers, Carl Anderson and Luke Gallows, after winning the AEW championship. throwing up the too sweet and, you know, saying, Kenny said himself, you know, getting the old Bullet Club back together. But then they kind of called it Biz Cliz, and then it was unclear whether they were going to, you know, just fucking...
I love that name.
Good brotherisms. And Kenta showing up as one of the most recent members of Bullet Club after, listeners may recall him returning to Japan in 2019 after his failed NXT run, and then being in the G1 and then turning on his former best friend Katsuyori Shibata in the finals of the G1. That threw additional fuel into fire as Kenta came to pay back the reigning U.S. champion Jon Moxley for attacking Kenta on New Japan Strong. But as I said, notably, he told Kenny Omega to shut the fuck up and refused to too sweet him back. So all of this is to say that, you know, a casual observer may be left wondering, well, what the fuck is going on? Like, what is any of this? And well, that's a really good question with a very long answer. But the short answer, of course, is Bullet Club has taken over the world once again. And so that begs the question, how did we get here? And so tonight, what we're going to be talking about is the rise of Bullet Club from just another faction to quite possibly the most well-known IP in wrestling today. Now, to answer the question of how did we get here, you have to go all the way back to the LA Dojo circa 2006, when two young men began training for a career in New Japan, Fergal Devitt and Chad Allegra. Now, Devitt and Allegra, despite having come up in Bray, Ireland and Asheville, North Carolina, respectively, they became best friends from the moment they began training together, and that helped cement a friendship with a little inside joke to each other, a handshake that only true fans of the sport would really appreciate. The North Carolina Wolves Pack signature, the Wolf Kiss. Of course, this became more well known as the secret handshake of the Click, consisting of Shawn Michaels, Scott Hall, Kevin Nash, and Triple H, who, listeners from the NWO episode may remember, were a backstage group of best friends in WWF. That kind of helped change wrestling forever when the curtain call of 1994 in Madison Square Garden happened, breaking kayfabe and kind of shattering illusions. And this handshake later became publicly known as the calling card of the brand new faction NWO and became known as the Too Sweet. Now, to hear Devitt tell it, we'd be on these 6 to 8 hour bus rides on the New Japan tour bus going from Tokyo to Osaka or to Kyushu and absolutely going insane on the bus and trying to think of ways to entertain ourselves. We went through this phase of quoting all the Attitude Era stuff. It got to the point where we'd be on the bus and 4 hours into a journey and there'd be complete silence. And we'd just look at each other and we wouldn't even say anything, but we'd both know that we were going to Too Sweet right then. And we would. And then we would go back to sleep or do whatever we were doing. We'd be too sweeting each other backstage before we went out or in the locker room that day or in the bar that night, which, by the way, very cute, incredibly nerdy. What are we doing? We just wake up and too sweet each other. Very, very interesting way to bond. But, you know, I guess let me not judge the wrestlers.
So, you know, it's funny. The legend I always heard was that somebody, I'm presumably the Click, probably Kevin Nash or Scott Hall, they saw some Japanese guy use it in one of their tours, and they thought it was pretty cool, and that's how they use it. The origins, believe it or not, come from the Grey Wolves, which was a horrible nationalistic right-wing group from Turkey.
No way.
Where they wouldn't too sweet each other, but they would do the wolf like this to one another, kind of like, you know, Heil Hitler and shit like that.
Oh, that's not... I did a lot of research. I didn't know that.
Yeah, one of my favorite streamers on Twitch is Hassan Piker, and someone sent him like a clip of Bullet Club or something like that when he was trying to get into wrestling, and he's like, oh shit, that's like the Turkish nationalistic like fucking sign. I tremendously doubt that's where they got it from, but it's just like an interesting crossover, you know what I mean? I don't picture anybody of the Click being Turkish nationalists, so just funny how things cross over sometimes.
It really is. That is a truly, you know, I thought I did my homework, and I did not do my homework, so
I mean, you did it from a wrestling standpoint. I didn't expect you to delve into Eurasian politics, but
the deep, here we dark are. Roots of the Too Sweet.
That's what you get for coming on to fucking Filthy Casuals, man.
That's right. That's right. Allegra followed up Devitt talking about them Too Sweeting each other by saying, "Then one day in the ring in Tokyo, Japan." That's his quote, not mine. "We just got a win. Finn got the win. He held the Too Sweet up in the air and looked at me. I started to get chills. I said, are we doing this right now?" And these two men, of course, are better known nowadays as Finn Balor and Machine Gun Carl Anderson. Though in these days, Finn was better known as Prince Devitt. So, flash forward to 2013, right? Full 7 years later. Devitt is a six-time IWGP Junior Heavyweight Tag Team Champion, with most of his success coming as a member of Apollo 55 alongside Ryusuke Taguchi, as well as being a three-time IWGP Junior Heavyweight Champion. So Prince Devitt at this point is a legendary junior, especially for a fucking gaijin. Legendary, in a very short amount of time accomplishing all of that. And Devitt was a longtime crowd favorite as the babiest of babyfaces, who started displaying a bit more pizzazz and cockiness, and eventually it led to him turning on Taguchi after an unsuccessful contention for a record-breaking seventh title reign against the Time Splitters, who listeners may know as Alex Shelley and Kushida. Devitt then, after, dubbed himself the real rock and roller and introduced former rugby player and behemoth of a man, the Tongan Bad Luck Fale, as his new bouncer. And he'd like come out riding on Fale's shoulders, very cute. And shortly after, Devitt was joined by Carl Anderson and the son of the legendary Haku or Meng, Tama Tonga, and they dubbed themselves Bullet Club in honor of Anderson's name, Machine Gun, and Devitt's previous nickname, The Real Shooter, and use of finger gun things. Pew, pew. pew, pew. Now, Anderson was a tag team specialist himself. He actually had a record-setting 564-day and 10-defense reign as IWGP tag team champions with Giant Bernard. Do you know who Giant Bernard is, Ryan?
That's Albert, baby.
That's Albert, as Bad Intentions. Now, much like Prince Devitt, Carl Anderson was also known as a great tournament wrestler who had found success in the New Japan Cup and G1, but continuously found himself stymied by one Hiroshi Tanahashi. And it was this hatred of Hiroshi Tanahashi that led to the Bullet Club's insurrection. But behind the scenes, Anderson, Tama Tonga, Fale, and Devitt were all best friends, with Devitt saying, "Essentially, we lived together, traveled together, ate together, drank together, and spent 4 years being in each other's company. We were closer to each other than we were to our families," dark, "due to the fact that we were in a foreign country and all going through the same issues of living in a non-English-speaking country." Which also has a lot of merit in its own right, in Japan specifically, because Japan is a notoriously... homogenous society, and one that is very difficult for a lot of people to understand the customs and social norms of. So that makes a lot of sense, honestly, that the gaijin not only would stick together, but that these four guys would really bond like that. I'm sure there's plenty of stories like that all throughout wrestling.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, like, I think people like really underestimate the cultural aspect of a lot of things within Japan. I was reading this article earlier about cultural appropriation and with kimonos in particular, and you know, that's not really a thing over there, because the company that made kimonos were actually happy at the fact that, like, you know, Westerners are buying it, and it rejuvenated their company. So, you know, I business is very important to them. You know, you hear, yeah, a lot of stories of people like working from the cradle to the grave, and like, you know, it's not uncommon, as we see with a lot of New Japan wrestlers, that they have loyalty to the company that they worked for. You know, you thought like American work ethic was pretty bad. Japanese work ethic goes like beyond that. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. There's a literal name for the social phenomenon of working yourself to death, or like work suicide. Like, Japan work culture is fucking insane. So, yeah, it's just, so it makes sense that like these four guys, especially in like a job situation, would really just tag themselves, you know, hang out together. So Bullet Club became hotter than hell almost instantly, right? This is 2013. And throughout the next year, Devitt would start challenging heavyweights while still being junior champion, saying he wanted to be the first guy to ever hold the junior and heavyweight championships at the same time. He unsuccessfully went against Kazuchika Okada after Bullet Club helped beat down the aging Hiroshi Tanahashi. Meanwhile, the group added three new members in Doc Gallows, a.k.a. Luke Gallows, and the Young Bucks, with Gallows and Anderson showing immediate chemistry and winning the IWGP Tag Team Championships and the Bucks winning the Junior Championships. This dominance would be short-lived, though, as Devitt and Taguchi waged war throughout 2013 and 2014 and ended up having one final match together at Invasion, the same event where 1 year prior their relationship had ended. Taguchi defeated Devitt despite repeated interference from the Bucks. The two men shook hands, and Devitt, who demanded the Bucks not interfere in the match, ended up coming to blows with them, and eventually they attacked him and he launched himself at the entirety of Bullet Club, thus ending his time with them. And as it would turn out, New Japan as a whole. Devitt would leave the following day for NXT and became Finn Balor, who, interestingly enough, I don't know if you knew this, do you know when Finn Balor showed up in NXT, what the first thing he did was?
Shit, you know, I'm trying to remember. I remember what Sami Zayn did. I remember what Kevin Owens did. I remember what Shinsuke did.
It's a small thing, but it's a fun thing. The first thing that he did was help out Hideo Itami.
Okay.
So just like a fun little bit of, this is of course Kenta well before joining Bullet Club, but that's a fun right. little bit of past and future coming together.
Did they look at, I'm disappointed. I can't recall this. Did they look at each other like a certain way? Like, I know you.
Possibly. I didn't watch the clip. They didn't really interact that much, though. You know, I mean, Hideo Itami was like strictly a Noah guy who would work All Japan shows. So he didn't really have like a ton of.
Oh, true. Yeah. I didn't Kenta, really think
Kenta
about that
Kenta didn't
aspect.
Do a ton of working in New Japan. Okay. But they were both world famous juniors at the same time, or at least, you know, countrywide juniors. So I'm sure they knew who each other were.
Yeah. I mean, you'd be hard pressed to not hear anybody mention Kenta. I mean, CM Punk used his finisher, for God's sakes.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And of course, Finn would then become the then longest reigning NXT champion before joining Raw in 2016 and then immediately defeating Seth Rollins to become the first ever Universal Champion. And the rest with Finn is history, and we will circle back with him later, right? So the beginnings of Bullet Club is in a lot of ways humble, right? And it's a simple enough gimmick, right? A bunch of foreigners coming in and just disrespecting the culture. They're all gaijin, but they really took New Japan by storm, and it was very centralized at this time. It was only a New Japan thing. You know, Finn, Fale, Tama Tonga, Carl Anderson, even the Bucks, really, none of them were that well known in America. Finn, not at all. You know, Prince Devitt wasn't known really in America at all. Carl Anderson worked in PWG and Ring of Honor. The Bucks worked in Ring of Honor. Fale and Tonga were, you know, Japan products basically entirely. So it was very central, but Japan loved them. They loved them from the jump. Now, my question to you is, because I wasn't watching, when Finn came over to NXT, was there an understanding of who he was? Obviously, I'm sure they talked up, you know, a big guy from Japan, but like, did you know who he was when he first showed up?
I understood he was a big deal. I just reading dirt sheets like Raha.com and like all those old ass dirt sheets from back in the day. Like, you constantly heard about Fergal Devitt, you know, Prince Devitt. I just never had the opportunity or availability to watch New Japan, so I couldn't really relate. But, you know, everybody freaked out when he signed, for sure. Whether or not Bullet Club was mentioned with him is another story. But yeah, certainly the name arose.
Yeah, and I don't think so either.
No, and that's just an testament of like how good Finn is.
The only thing that Finn took over from being Prince Devitt is Devitt started painting himself in different colors, and then so like that became the demon.
Yes,
that's the only thing that stuck.
Always heavily rumored back and forth or not, WWE was going to let him do that.
And then, of course, like the Balor Club thing. So, like, they talked it up, but by the time Balor Club was starting to be a thing, he was already in NXT for a while.
Yeah. And now, Bullock Club is already on their descent, which you will about to get into.
Yes, but first, before the descent, must come the ascent. And so the same night that Devitt left, AJ Styles debuted as the newest member of Bullet Club and immediately attacked Kazuchika Okada, declaring Okada to be the same young boy that he knew from his ill-fated TNA excursion, and demanded a title match the following month at Wrestling Dontaku. That was the same event that Bullet Club was born 1 year ago. Now, Styles was immediately granted his match, and after Yujiro Takahashi defected from Okada's Chaos stable and interfered in the match, thus becoming the first Japanese member of Bullet Club, AJ Styles defeated Okada for the IWGP Heavyweight Championship. So 1 year later, Bullet Club held the IWGP Heavyweight Tag Team and Junior Tag Team Championships, with AJ being considered the Ring of Honor leader of the stable, and Carl Anderson being considered the main faction leader. Though AJ would kind of become considered the one true leader. AJ felt that there was no leadership in Bullet Club, but that's kind of what ended up happening, is AJ became the de facto leader.
You know, it's funny, you mentioned to me before, was I aware of, you know, Balor at the time when he first came over? I was aware of AJ Styles in New Japan, because AJ Styles was always like, you know, the sought after name for WWE to finally land, and will he, won't he come to WWE? But when he went to Japan, everybody was just like, dude, AJ Styles has a beard. AJ Styles has long hair now, and he's fucking like absolutely killing it on the Japanese scene. So this is like this moment where you're noting right now is like the first time that like I actually gave New Japan the time of day, you know, just being the lapsed fan. And, you know, because of AJ Styles, like, holy shit, like he's having a career renaissance here. Not that he ever lost it. It was just that he was buried in fucking TNA, you know?
He was like the guy who was also kind of like not the guy in TNA, because like it, like with later stage WCW, it was the Kurt Angle show, it was the Sting show, Hogan, Jeff Jarrett.
So, 100%.
Like, I think you'd be hard pressed to say that AJ was not like a star in TNA, but was he like who he should have been the entire time? No, he really wasn't.
Yeah. I mean, you know, Mr. TNA, I guess you have to give to fucking Jeff Jarrett. But dude, I mean, like, he's Mr. TNA Jr. He was the guy that, like, you know, should have always been number one. I get they had to give it to Kurt Angle because he was a big name at the time and some other people, but
Perky, you know. Perky Angle.
Perky? Oh, God.
Perk Angle. That's fucking machine of a wrestler, but boy, was that just not a thing
dark
that impacted.
Period, man.
Very, very fucking
afraid.
Dark.
We were fucking afraid watching him, you know?
Should have been.
We'll go in depth to this on another episode, but yes, we were very fucking afraid at that time.
He literally got fired from WWE because they were like, Kurt, this is a problem and you're not dealing with it and we can't risk it. And then Impact was like, yo, you want to come here and we'll just ignore all of that?
Yeah, dude.
And
yeah,
Kurt was like, yeah, dude, sick.
That's exactly what fucking happened, man. I mean, thank God he's healthy and clean, but
yeah, we're lucky he can fucking move, honestly. That's anyway, true, so 1 year later, right, Bullet Club is holding a whole lot of gold. And then 1 month later after that, even though the tag championships would get dropped, Bad Luck Fale would defeat Shinsuke Nakamura for the IWGP Intercontinental Championship, and Yujiro would defeat Tomohiro Ishii for the NEVER Openweight, giving Bullet Club control of every single heavyweight title in the company, and even getting their own personal young boy. Do you know who that young boy was, Ryan?
Mr. Cody Hall.
Cody Hall, that's right. The son of NWO co-founder Scott Hall. A little bit of fun symmetry there. Now, you know what? I'll talk about this after. But, you know, so though titles would come and go, Bullet Club would continue to grow and dominate the industry in Japan and now America. With the addition of the cleaner Kenny Omega, who had spent the last 6 years predominantly in DDT in Japan, Chase Owens, and Jeff Jarrett.
Oh, of course, Bullet Club legend. Poresu legend.
Jeff Jarrett. Jeff Jarrett. That was
a pretty big deal, though, because it was bridging the two together. I mean, like...
Sure, it was, yeah.
I choose fucking Virgil to integrate the two factions before I would choose Jeff Jarrett, but hey, that's another story.
What are you going to do?
I need Olive Garden Daddy Virgil. I mean, by all accounts, like, the older wrestlers, like, as much as people were just like... your stall, you're just NWO Junior. Like all the older wrestlers have, like, they respect what Bullet Club does. You know what I mean?
And you know what? That's what I was going to talk about later. But you know what? Since you brought it up, yeah, it's worth mentioning that multiple members of NWO, like Kevin Nash and Scott Hall and all of the big players, have referred to Bullet Club as like a version of NWO if everyone in NWO was a good wrestler. I forget exactly who it was. I don't know.
That's
if
a great
it
way
was,
of putting it.
I don't know if it was Waltman or if it was somebody else, but somebody called Bullet Club bell to bell far better than NWO as wrestlers.
It
which,
might
like,
have
been
Jarrett, honestly. I had a quote from him. I think there's a reverence for fraternities within wrestling, and look no further than the Bullet Club for a modern day fraternity. What do I mean by that? I mean, like, you know, Four Horsemen, there's, you know, various groups that have popped over that are kind of bigger than the promotion itself, you know? I mean, yeah. During the Four Horsemen are way bigger than WCW was back then, especially mm-hmm. in the Jim Herd era, because...
Ding dong, you know, hello!
Yeah, you had the ding dongs now. You know, it's just because of the people within the faction itself, and, you know, like, we could talk about... Like, when I mentioned Four Horsemen to you, Damien, like, what's the first thing that comes to your mind? Like, oh, WCW, oh boy. No, it's the four individuals that were in.
It's, yeah, absolutely. Because right. It wasn't even really WCW, it was JCP still, and then it was WCW, but you're 100% right. And you think very specifically, you don't even think, like, Sting necessarily. You think Ric Flair, Ole Anderson, Arn Anderson, Tully Blanchard. Absolutely. They far surpass any promotion they were a part of. Yeah, and you are right. It was Jeff Jarrett who said that the main difference between the two is Bullet Club is off the charts, bell to bell, more talented. And Kevin Nash said also that they were a more athletic version and informally passed the torch from his stable to Bullet Club. So exactly to your point, like you might think that people would be pissed off about like gimmick infringement, but not them. And you know what? That's kind of very in line with who NWO, like specifically who like Scott Hall and Kevin Nash are kind of as performers. Kevin Nash got a lot of flack for like, oh, Kevin Nash isn't willing to do the work. He's lazy. He's whatever. But you know what Kevin Nash was? Kevin Nash was a guy that was like, yo, I'm not fucking dying for your company. I'm here to make my money, do some cool shit, and then it's time to go and it's time to go. So
he's smart, man. It's a good fucking business move. The worst thing that they could have done during the Bullet Club's rise would to be like, no, you can't use our shit because the fans would turn on them. And yeah. What's happening now? We're talking about NWO within a Bullet Club episode. So, I mean, it works.
Absolutely.
They know where the business is going, you know. They've all had their demons. They all have their individual falls from the wrestling world. Mm-hmm. But, you know, X-Pac, Scott Hall, Nash, they understand like where the business is going and where it should go. So I will always give them that credit.
Absolutely. Now, right, so Bullet Club really ascended in the 3 years of AJ Styles being leader. But, you know, all things end and become something new. And Bullet Club is no different. Like Devitt before them, AJ Styles, Gallows, and Anderson all left for WWE. But not before Kenny Omega and the Bucks kicked AJ out of Bullet Club at New Beginning 2016, the day after AJ Styles unsuccessfully contested for Shinsuke Nakamura's Intercontinental Championship, with Gallows and Anderson's help and bringing Omega to the forefront alongside the Bucks, who then dubbed themselves the Elite. And that's also a very funny, memeable moment because, like, after Kenny and the rest of Bullet Club, you know, beat them, Kenny kind of turns into the cleaner and he's like, you know, because Bullet Club is for life, except AJ Styles, as he's like just holding AJ Styles' head. And then, of course, AJ shows up at the Rumble and, you know, well, we know who AJ Styles is. AJ Styles, multiple time WWE champion, one of the best champions of the modern era, and a real, you know, AJ Styles has been one of the very few stars in recent memory to come over to WWE and just kind of be treated exactly how he should have been treated the whole time and is exactly a big deal and can be anywhere in the card. Now, Ryan, as I've mentioned multiple times, right? For me, wrestling kind of started and stopped with WWE once WCW stopped existing. So by this point, this is 2016, my interest in wrestling is starting to get back in, but I know nothing about Ring of Honor. I know nothing about what Bullet Club's doing. So can you shine a little bit of a spotlight on what that era was once Omega took control?
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, as I mentioned before, I was watching New Japan for AJ Styles, but now at this point, I can confidently say that I was watching New Japan for New Japan. I still remember where I was when it was the New Year's Dash show, when friend of the show, Uncle Tony, told me to come over, and he's like, dude, you need to watch this event tonight. I think something big is going to happen. Sure enough, AJ Styles was kicked out. But then a young and up-and-comer came onto the scene that I was not aware of at the time, and that was, of course, Mr. Kenny Omega. How much did you know about him? Did you not know about him until it was like, he faced Okada, or did you know about him prior to that?
No, I had no idea of who the cleaner was. I had no idea about the DDT stuff. I don't think I really became aware of Kenny Omega as like a wrestler until I would say the earliest 2017. I feel like has to be the first time.
Yeah, at Wrestle Kingdom 10, the Bucks regained the Junior Heavyweight Tag Team Championship. And then at the same night, Omega lost the Junior Heavyweight Championship. And also Gallows and Anderson lost the Heavyweight Tag Team Championship. So not a good match. But after this event occurred, Omega had no desire to continue within the Juniors. He stated that he did not want a rematch with Kushida, but instead he wanted a match with Nakamura for the Intercontinental Championship. And in the aftermath of, Omega becoming the leader of the Bullet Club, he and the Young Bucks would go on to form their own subgroup within the stable called, as we all know, the Elite. Mm-hmm. And this kind of became like everybody like and their mother was associated with Bullet Club at this point. But now they got to, really start taking over the name for themselves. Kind of like the Wolfpack and the NWO,
Yeah.
I think they really wanted to establish themselves as like, the main NWO, like talking about Hall, Nash, and Hogan. Mm-hmm. And then you had the Wolfpack, which, I think Nash started to sort of like, the up and comers like within the faction, because at that point it was like, Jesus Christ, it was like, it's not WCW, it's NWO wrestling.
Quite literally, yeah.
Quite literally, yeah. So. But yeah, no, at the time they really started to, dedicate themselves to, being the Elite. Omega stated that he and the Young Bucks were the Elite, but accepted if New Japan continued calling them Bullet Club in parentheses as a stable. Because at this point, New Japan Wrestling, if you were not a hardcore viewer, if you were outside of, the cultural hemisphere that it existed within, you watched New Japan because of Bullet Club, Mm-hmm. Is that a fair assumption, do you feel, looking back on it?
I mean, definitely, because like I said, since I had no knowledge of any of this shit until, 3-4 years ago.
Yeah, no, I'm just saying, reading everything.
But no, 100%. Like,
okay.
They were the top sellers at Pro Wrestling Tees in 2016. They sold like 400,000 shirts in 4 months in 2017. And all of that really coincides with when Kenny Omega took over. So like you said, like they were that's when it really became worldwide. It was under the AJ that they had the most success in Japan, but that's when I can tell, like, that's when shit really became global for them.
Right. And I think it's fair to say that Kenny and the Young Bucks really broke that glass ceiling, whereas AJ got them to the ascent of the mountain. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And, two things culminated within this rise that Kenny Omega was, when the rise was occurring, two things occurred at the same time. Now, the Young Bucks, they were no slouches to Ring of Honor. They existed within the company for the last 8 years at this point. They had some breaks here and there. They went to TNA and had their infamous Generation Me run as the tag team.
Yep.
They eventually came back to Ring of Honor and, still used the Generation Me name, but kind of like adapted a different style to what they were doing. This is when you may recognize that they started, becoming the quote unquote like Hardy ripoffs, as some people mm-hmm. will call them. But it wasn't that. It was just them, merely adapting to the fact that Bullet Club kind of borrowed like little pieces here and there from wrestling and pop culture within it. During this time as well, Kenny Omega began his G1 run. And I think this is where everybody became familiar with Kenny Omega, the cleaner, and the character associated with it. Within this run, you saw the first ladder match in New Japan history, where he faced Michael Elgin.
Oh, interesting.
Yes, that was the first ladder match, believe it or not, in Japan. I'm very surprised. You know, they had people jumping off buildings and smashing into C4. But, you know, the occurrence of a ladder being in a match never really came up with Japanese wrestling. Am I right on that?
Yeah, ladders is a step too far, damn it.
Way too far, especially in death matches. But anyway, so
too far, too far. Barbed wire, yes. Lights, yes. Ladders, what the fuck are you doing? Get this shit off my TV.
So, you know, Young Bucks got the Ring of Honor tag team championships here and there, but I think the ultimate culmination of where this run was ultimately going to was, of course, Omega versus Okada at Wrestle Kingdom. And you can kind of look at this event two ways. This was also the culmination and the end of Bullet Club, I feel. Mainly because, you know, it's like, you know, relative topic here. In the stock market, whenever you find out about a certain stock, right, it's too late. Because that means that, you know, either it sold too much and you know about it, or you missed the rise of it within the market itself.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not taking away from Omega versus Okada. That's one of the best modern wrestling matches in history. But then you started to see a shift. You know, at this point, you know, the Bullet Club name and brand and image within wrestling itself was way solidified.
Mm-hmm.
At this time, you had the Bullet Club t-shirt being the number one seller at Hot Topic, mm-hmm. which for, you know, a secondary wrestling company at the time, not an easy feat.
No, yeah, for sure.
Not by any stretch.
I mentioned them being the number one seller on pro wrestling tees, but that's a fucking wrestling website. To do it in right. Hot Topic is something very different.
But as soon as Omega had the match with Okada, obviously winning the first time, the draw the second time, and losing the last time, you know, within this time is when you started seeing the Elite become the solidified name within the faction as opposed to Bullet Club. This is when you saw Cody come onto the scene, because of course, when you think Bullet Club, you think Cody. And that's no disrespect to Cody, as much as we joke around about.
Yes, it is.
Okay, it's complete disrespect to Cody.
It's 100% disrespect to Cody.
Cody rode the pigtails of this fucking scene, and all right, let me dial it back. But yes, this is when you started seeing Cody come into the fold. This is when you kind of saw the Elite web series came out around this time, and people were really becoming more akin to like, okay, so there's like this solidified storyline going on outside of WWE, and a lot of more people were becoming aware of it. As the Being the Elite series continued, they used a culmination of different Ring of Honor wrestlers. One of them being Punishment Martinez, a.k.a.
Damian Priest.
Damian Priest, of course. Becoming Damian Priest. And, you know, this is when it kind of became, quote-unquote, jumping the shark. And it was because of this reason in particular. It's because they were in a holding pattern, right? You know, you mentioned earlier about how the Elite didn't really feel respected by the contracts that they were given. But at the same time, I think, you know, it was quite obvious that they were, you know, gunning to either go to one federation in America, whether it was WWE or building within from Ring of Honor and really taking that promotion to like the next step of where it was. It was always rumored that WWE offered the Young Bucks like this ridiculous massive contract.
Yeah,
that they turned down. I don't know, because it's like the Young Bucks can talk about that all day. I don't think Triple H is going to come out and be like, no, it wasn't like that. Like, you know.
Yeah.
I think they ran with it a little bit. I could see from New Japan's perspective, though, you know, they didn't obviously give them the money because I don't think they like could afford to. And we talked about the cultural ties within New Japan wrestling and Japanese culture. like, as much as they were benefiting from Bullet Club, as much as they were benefiting from this Gaijin faction, they're not going to, like, completely hand over the reins to them. Am I incorrect on that?
No, I mean, I think that that's 100% correct. And you mentioned, like, things really starting to, you know, get blown up and jumping the shark, right? Because, like you said, on the one hand, it's definitely inarguable that the Bucks and Omega, they launched it into the fucking stratosphere. They built on, they took what Devitt and Styles put together and they just fucking launched it, right? And the Bucks have always been masters of marketing themselves, right? So it's no surprise. And, you know, it's not like they showed up out of nowhere. The Bucks were around for the first iteration starting in 2013 on. Omega came into the fold like a year or two after that as well. So it's not like they fucking showed up out of nowhere. Right. But, you know, over on the Ring of Honor side, you know, you involve Adam Cole. And then you involve Hangman Adam Page, who, as the Bucks ribbed him for in AEW, was just a jobber. Then you involved Marty Scurll after that. Then you involved Cody. And this is when the Civil War starts happening, where...
Correct.
A lot of it is storyline, but also a lot of it is kind of like, if I'm Tongaloa, or if I'm Tama Tonga, if I'm Bad Luck Fale, what do I think about the Kenny Omega and the Bucks kind of openly talking about, like, oh yeah, we don't really want to be Bullet Club, but New Japan wants us to, so we're the elite. Like, I'd probably feel disrespected, and the locker room, I'm sure, had to feel a little bit like that, but also that has a lot to do with ownership as well, 100%.
I completely understand their plight, you know, Tama Tonga and Tonga Loa. You know, Harold May wasn't the best head of New Japan. I think he held them back because he was kind of dissuaded by all the, you know, Bullet Club events that occurred. But, you know, I mean, like I mentioned, they're not going to hand over the reins to Bullet Club. It was a cool aspect that, like, Bullet Club stretched out through every single major program in wrestling around the world. You know, you had Adam Cole and Ring of Honor. You had, at this point, Gallows and Anderson and AJ Styles and Finn Balor in WWE and NXT. And, you know, it's like, imagine being Tama Tonga and Tonga Loa being originally part of this group, and then you have a friend of a friend like Cody coming in and fucking just, like, you know, appropriating everything. I'd be pissed too. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And is it... I understand both sides in, like, I think that the elite saw what they were. They saw what they brought to the table, and they were like, yo, honestly, you're not paying me enough for this. But I also think that New Japan, like you said, listen, you guys don't fucking run the joint. That's not how it works around here. This isn't WCW. Like, that's not the way that we run this operation. It's not just about merch sales and shit. It's not to say that they didn't give a shit about money. And, you know, the Jacksons talk a lot about how merchandising really was, like, they didn't benefit from all those shirts being sold that, like, that was kind of New Japan exclusively. But yeah, I think that the reality is that New Japan really undervalued them compared to what they were worth. And I think that they also a little bit overvalued themselves in the respect of that particular company at that point in time, feels like.
Absolutely.
Accurate.
I mean, like, that was their fucking money trade, man. Let's not disagree here. You know, not, I'm just saying, like, you know, not me and you, but.
No, 100%. That's, you know, it's, I mean, the gravy,
like,
train.
So they, it was like a 50-50 split here, you know? I mean, we can argue who was right in this situation, but I think amicably they split and it worked out for everybody, honestly.
Well, wasn't amicable at first, right? And to get to the last part of the discussion, right? What's happening now and the impact, right? Haha. You know, Kenny takes ownership and, like we said, blows Bullet Club up to the fucking moon, but also kind of shits on it the whole time. He has the trilogy against Okada, some of the greatest matches in wrestling history, from in-ring perspective, from a storytelling perspective, just really great stuff, right? Cody shows up in the second match, goes to throw in the towel, and the Bucks have to stop him. Then that creates problems between him and Kenny. The next night, the next defense that Kazuchika Okada has after that match ends in a 60-minute draw between Omega and Okada is Okada versus Cody in America. Omega does the same thing, comes out with a towel, kind of fucks with Cody. Then they end up having a singles match where Cody beats him after the Bucks try to help Kenny by super kicking Cody, but they miss. And it was to establish leadership of Bullet Club. And the whole time, the Tongans are staying the fuck out of it. Tama Tonga, Tongaloa, Bad Luck Fale, they're like not getting involved in this shit at all. And, you know, Cody teams up with like Hangman Adam Page, and Chase Owens teams up with Kenny. It's this whole thing. And then eventually, right, Kenny beats Okada in the 2 out of 3 falls match, considered to be one of, if not the greatest wrestling match ever, depending on who you are, who you talk to. Reunites with the Young Bucks after that's an issue. He's reunited with the Golden Lovers, with Kota Ibushi. He's like clarifying that, no, I'm still in charge of Bullet Club, but I'm going to make Cody my first defense. He beats Cody, and then Tama Tonga, Tongaloa, and their father, King Haku, comes out to congratulate Kenny, only to then beat down the entire Elite in the middle of the ring. The Elite cohorts, Hangman Adam Page and Marty Scurll, come out to try and assist. They get beat down. Yujiro Takahashi and Chase Owens come to try and create harmony between the two. They get beat down as well. Then Cody comes out, and the Tongans offered him a chair. Said, fucking finish the deal. Because at this point, Cody was kind of like in cahoots with Bullet Club, the other side of Bullet Club. And he says no, and he attacks the Tongans with a chair, and he gets beat down. They take off their shirts. They're calling themselves BCOG, the firing squad. And they say, fuck you guys. Like, we're Bullet Club. We don't know what you are. So then, like you mentioned earlier, you get like a Wolfpack NWO situation where you have Bullet Club Elite and Bullet Club OG, and they like are feuding with one another, but they're also kind of not dealing with one another. But the Elite all get together happy. And then at Wrestle Kingdom 13, the entirety of Bullet Club Elite, Kenny Omega, the Bucks, Cody, Marty Scurll, Hangman Adam Page, Yujiro, and Chase Owens, they all lose all of their matches. But Jay White, who recently defected from Chaos, beats Okada and joins Bullet Club as the new leader of Bullet Club OG. And of course, after that, they all leave. They're not associated with New Japan. They start AEW. Jay White takes over as the official leader. Yujiro and Chase Owens sticks around with Bullet Club OG. They just become regular Bullet Club again. And that's kind of where we are today. So for the last part here, I don't want to talk about Jay's reign, which is obviously still going, and there's plenty to talk about there. A lot of people, myself included, feel like it's Bullet Club a little bit more the way it was supposed to be. Although now it is equally as fucking massive, and like ever since Evil joined with Dick Togo, I haven't been super into it, but whatever. That's not the point. The point that the last thing that I want to discuss here is, so this is the history of Bullet Club, right? This is Bullet Club from its inception to where we are today. And we come to the full circle of starting off today talking about Kenta showing up in AEW. And we talk about Kenny Omega calling himself Bullet Club with the Good Brothers and the Young Bucks again. We have Tama Tonga and Bad Luck Fale shit-talking Kenny Omega and anyone else trying to associate themselves with that version of Bullet Club, saying, if the Tongans aren't in it, it's not Bullet Club. They're the only ones that have ever been in all of it. When you take a larger look at wrestling as a whole, right, what do you see all over the place, okay? In New Japan, you've got real Bullet Club, right? Bullet Club has the junior tag championships. Right now, they got the tag championships. Jay and G.O.D. going for the 6 men. But Jay White is a main eventer. He's a main event guy. Indisputably, Evil was just double champion for a hot minute. Kenta, number one contender to the U.S. championship. Then you come over to WWE. Finn Balor in his return to NXT. Second reign as NXT champion. In a phenomenal reign. A reign in which when he returned, what did he return as, Ryan?
Jay White.
Finn Balor returned as Jay White? That's what he did?
Yes, Finn Balor returned as Jay White.
Very good. Finn Balor showed up, of course, calling himself the Prince. He said the Prince has returned.
The Promised Prince, yes.
The Promised Prince, going back to the real rock and roller. AJ Styles, most recently with Gallows and Anderson, calling themselves the Club. AJ Styles, a multiple-time WWE champion, now in another match for the WWE championship.
Right, AEW, even to the point where Gallows and Anderson were wearing like their old face paint.
Yes.
Which is something I thought they should always have stuck with, to be honest with you.
And AEW, Kenny Omega, AEW champion. The Good Brothers now an Impact tag champions. The reality is, Bullet Club is fucking everywhere. Adam yes. Cole, the longest reigning NXT champion. So my question to you, Ryan, is when you look at Bullet Club now and you look at the impact it's had, what is your impression?
Well, first things that come to mind is I know Guerrillas of Destiny and the associated members isn't everybody's cup of tea. Mm-hmm. But you got to give them fucking credit for taking a dead brand that honestly, after it was done being used by the Elite, was kind of dead on arrival. And, you know, when you think of like the prototypical annoying wrestling fan, you probably pictured him with a Bullet Club shirt on. But they made the brand cool again and they made it usable again. And that's not an easy feat. And that's certainly hitched to Jay White having a great run within New Japan. I think he's certainly one of my MVPs, mm-hmm. if we're talking post-Elite era here.
Oh, yeah, 100%. But,
you know, I think what the ultimate goal here is that no matter what iteration of Bullet Club we're talking about, it's in the collective consciousness of the modern wrestling fan. And everybody, it doesn't matter whether or not you go back to the beginning days and you know who started it and whatnot, like there is a good chance that within every major storyline of wrestling across every federation probably involves a former or current member of the Bullet Club. And, you know, its arms reaching throughout wrestling is just always going to be permanent. And, you know, where do we go from here? You know, you talking about this was like, you know, mentioning Civil War within, you know, the Marvel universe. It inevitably leads to this. I don't want to mark out super hard and start making like, you know, future storylines here. But I mean, if we are going to open the door, I think, you know, the common shared interest amongst every, promotion is Bullet Club. And I think it's the everlasting storyline that you can use to connect everyone together.
And look, to be completely transparent, right? There are plenty of people who not only hated the Bullet Club Civil War proper, but want nothing to do with it now. They don't want a rerun of Bullet Club Civil War. They're not interested. And I get that because, look, was it an interesting angle? Yeah, in a lot of ways it was. You're always, Kenny and the Bucks and Cody, they all know how to sell themselves. They know how to sell matches. All the shit we talk about Cody doesn't detract from the fact that he is a world-class promo, even back then. Back then it was only 3 years ago, but still, and he's a damn good wrestler, right? So there was something compelling about it, but like you said, it wasn't what Bullet Club really was. And it was so meta because that's everything that the Elite are, right? They're nothing if not meta. It's a wink at the camera. So Kenny Omega coming out as Kenny Omega, heel Kenny Omega, and talking about, where the Elite fuck Bullet Club. It's also kind of true. That's also like kind of what they were doing. And are they bad guys for that? No, they're doing what they feel is in their best interest as wrestlers because they don't give a shit about the company and they're not obligated to. But like you said, you have to give it to Tama Tonga, who is one of the most charismatic dudes in wrestling. Not everyone's cup of tea, but very charismatic. You have to give it to him and Fale sticking to it, knowing what to do. You got to give it to Gato for knowing how to bring Bullet Club back from the brink when the Elite really, like, from their perspective, fucked them. And Jay White has been everything and more that they could have hoped for. He's engaging. The crowds love him. He's interesting. He's amazing in the ring. He's a good storyteller. He can fucking talk. The only thing he can't do is speak Japanese. And, that's not that important to Bullet Club as a whole. But to your point, right? Like, everywhere you look, there's a Bullet Club member, a former Bullet Club member somewhere in a storyline. the Undisputed Era, right? Those are all guys that were involved with Bullet Club, or in Adam Cole's case, members of Bullet Club. The reality is that they're worldwide for a reason. And so...
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, as we were about to say it again, Bullet Club, you don't even need the name anymore. And what I mean by that is, like, these guys can all walk into a ring together, and you know that there's animosity between the three groups that we mentioned, the Elite, current Bullet Club. And I guess there's not really a third. I was going to say, like, if AJ Styles and, you know...
No, it's really, it's at this point, it's the right. American Club and
yeah.
Bullet Club actual.
Yeah. And, you know, it's just, I think the animosity, besides using the name, it runs deeper as like, hey, we know who you are. You had an opportunity. And this is, of course, speaking kayfabe, because obviously it didn't work out like this due to money yeah. reasons and yada, yada, yada. Hey. You guys used us. You guys used the name. You guys used the brand to get popular, and then you left us to make more money on your own, starting your own company. So I think that extends past, you know, any brand name, faction name, whatever, Turkish National Sign, whatever. you know, that's the ultimate storyline. And the best parts of wrestling is when things organically create itself like that.
Yeah. You know?
And it's not a bad thing. Everybody left to make their own money, and they revolutionized modern wrestling by finally creating, you know, still have a ways to go, but it's a formidable option to WWE. And to do that in the current landscape of wrestling, not an easy thing to do.
No.
So,
it's not.
You know, and it just harkens back to my previous point, like where we're at right now, the fact that, like, you know, the tireless work of the quote unquote, like, OG Bullet Club, putting in the work to get it back to where it was, you know, it shouldn't be overlooked. You know, where do you ultimately think it leads from here?
So here's the thing, right? Nobody's fucking listening to this podcast for our fantasy booking, but let's try to look at the facts in front of us and try to come away with something from there, right? Now, look, Tama Tonga, he's been talking shit to all of these guys for years. Anytime Gallows and Anderson do anything, he's been talking shit, right? Could be a work, could not be a work, could be real life beef, who knows, right? But more than likely, it's probably just a work. But since Kenny joined up with the Good Brothers, Tama Tonga's been shit talking them. Kota Ibushi and Kenny Omega, for the first time since Kenny left, directly addressed one another on Twitter using Michael Nakazawa as a translator in the same way that they did back in their DDT days. Tama Tonga responds to both of them. Kenta shows up and Tongaloa immediately responds to Kenta on Twitter going, hey, let me know how the new place looks. I'll be making a trip in soon. I think the reality is AEW does not put in any sort of lip service to New Japan without there being more than just this one thing. And I think in New Japan's case, with new management, with different people in, the reality is time heals all wounds and money heals all wounds. The reality is you're not able to get all of your talent all the time whenever you need them. You're trying to expand out into America. New Japan Strong's got a lot of interesting stuff happening. And in its own right, there's some crossovers. You got Impact there. You got MLW. You got Ring of Honor. But what benefits New Japan most right now? And am I saying this is going to be a permanent partnership? No. Nothing ever is permanent, especially in this industry. It could blow up tomorrow. But the reality is, there is fucking money in Jon Moxley. There is money in Kenny Omega and Kazuchika Okada, in Kota Ibushi and Kenny Omega, in the Bucks and the Tongans. There is money there. I think ultimately what you're going to see is the New Japan talent that resides in Florida. I think Jay White will show up on AEW at some point, especially because Kenny Omega mentioning Brother Switchblade like that to Kenta, I don't think that's just a
that's
cute
pretty
little,
obvious, yeah.
It could be, of course, because like we said, they're masters of the meta. But I don't think that is nothing. I think the reality is maybe they don't know how the partnership goes. Maybe they're feeling it out. Am I saying Kazuchika Okada shows up on an episode of Dynamite? Certainly not anytime soon, and who the fuck knows. But I don't think that Fale and Tama Tonga and Jay White constantly reference what Kenny Omega and them are doing. I don't think Kenny Omega and the Bucks and Gallows and Anderson go back at them. I don't think Finn Balor tweets all of them together just because it's a fun little haha, we're all in the same club.
They love the wink and the nod, especially the Elite.
They like sure do. They sure fucking do. But the reality is that when I look at this, the reason Bullet Club Civil War didn't work out is because you mentioned before, they're kind of coasting. All In happened early 2018. They already knew what they were doing. So this, and that was after months of planning. So it didn't work because the investment wasn't there the way it should be. Now, there's a reason to make that storyline work that can be mutually beneficial. Why the fuck don't you?
Yeah, and the last point I want to make is something that I think we overlooked, is that the long-awaited rumored New Japan American show. They went as far as opening an American dojo, as we mentioned many times here before. You know, are they, like, obviously COVID delayed a lot of plans, but as we know, like, they didn't make a title for nothing. They obviously want to follow through with this.
Mm-hmm.
So what better way to culminate storylines in and out of the promotion in order to lead through and obviously play out and culminate on this brand new American show that you want to produce? I think it would have been short-sighted and, you know, ill-advised for them to do all this and not have it play out on some degree.
Mm-hmm.
Wrestling is a fickle business. You don't always get what you want in these aspects, but I mean, like, hey, hats off to them. If they're doing this, you know, almost 2-year storyline to have a play out on their brand new television show in America, that's pretty goddamn good. And they, yeah, like, if every company has a working relationship, you know, I think Impact at pretty much at this point, Don Callis is like, look, if you guys want to make it happen, we're fucking there. Just let us know when to show up.
Mm-hmm.
Tony Khan has some reservations. Obviously, I think his gripes are more with, you know, the Harold Mage group, as and the new owner's like, yeah, fuck them. We don't worry about it. Where do you want us to sign? Like, they get it. They want to make money again.
Yeah.
I don't think they have to worry about, I mean, like, at this point, New Japan isn't going to have another Bullet Club renaissance. You know what I mean? They're not going to strike lightning in a bottle twice with the world market like they did. So you know what? They got to that point. By all accounts, it should have been over, but thanks to the dedication of, you know, AEW and Impact and, like, you know, all these guys trying to make a solid second option in wrestling, you can have it play out just like that.
Absolutely. And it all boils down to what is mutually beneficial. And look, to be clear, New Japan at this point does have a global market, but what gets them to that next level? And it's not, oh, AEW, the best fucking promotion. Like, in an ideal world for everybody, New Japan would work with WWE. That's the thing that would make the most sense for everybody. But it's not going to happen, not with Vince at the reins, not in this current climate. There's just no chance of that happening. So AEW makes the most sense. And look, the reality also is when it's time for Young Lions to go out on excursion, you would send him to CMLL. You'd send him to TNA. You'd send him to Ring of Honor. Send him to fucking AEW. Send him to Dark. Same thing with if you have an American market, you have people that travel between Florida and Japan. They're in Florida. It's something that makes sense on a lot of levels. Will it happen? We don't know. Just because we think as wrestling fans it makes sense doesn't mean it actually does in dollar and cents. But
no, in fact, everything that we probably predicted over
is going to be fucking nothing. We've ruined
it
all.
This show never plays out, especially me.
But for now, if nothing else, if absolutely nothing else, we can appreciate the fact that Kenta showed up on AEW, that AEW is openly talking about New Japan. New Japan is openly talking about AEW. And if nothing else happens for the foreseeable future, that in and of itself, in my opinion, is good for wrestling. And does it make WWE shit their pants? No, nothing does. WWE is on a totally different fucking level. But like you said, it provides an option that hasn't been there for a very long time. And you know what? I will take AAA and Impact and AEW and New Japan and NWA any fucking day of the week. It's awesome. I love to see it. I can't wait for like Nick Aldis to show up somewhere. The possibilities, it's just exciting to be able to talk about. It's exciting to be able to not just talk about, oh, are they going to go to WWE and be able to be like, hey, where are they going to go? Who do they work with? And it's just exciting. And in all of the fucking shit of this year, it's nice to see that like wrestling actually has something interesting happening, something really historic.
You know, it's becoming increasingly obvious that like, you know, the pandemic, and you could say this about any industry, but like in particular to wrestling, like they had a lot of do or die moments. And, you know, it's very easy for anybody to say like, okay, like WWE is not going to fucking participate in any of this. But at the same time, you know, it's like, I kind of believe Triple H when he says it, you know what I mean? Whether or not that's just me being the, I don't know.
Mark.
It's a mark, yeah. I was trying to think of like, I was going to say Mark, but I mean like the optimistic Mark, whatever. The delusional Mark.
Mark.
If there's money to be made, I think they would do it.
Yeah.
You know?
If there's money to be made, but how you get there, who the fuck knows? And
exactly.
At the end of the day, this is all possible because an Irish lad and a dude from Asheville threw up the fucking wolf pack in the middle of a ring one time and made something happen. All of this is because of Tama Tonga, because of Bad Luck Fale, because of Finn Balor, because of Carl Anderson. That is the only reason we're talking about this shit right now. And that's where we end here, is the full circle of Bullet Club from beginning to end, from beginning to where we are now. And it makes all the sense in the world that the largest crossover that we've seen maybe since WCW and New Japan in the 90s in Korea, in since All In, the biggest crossover that we've seen. And it's just exciting for wrestling fans. And so as we begin to wrap up here, Ryan, do you have a legend killer for us today?
I do. And I just sent it to you. It should be on your phone.
This is one of those guys that I could guess in three different decades. Okay.
Well, okay. I thought it might have been a little obvious. I'll give you my first. All right. So you have it pulled up, right?
Have you not done this often enough with me to know that whatever you think is obvious isn't for me?
Well, no, I have caveman era technology, so I just want to make sure that you receive the actual
I have
picture.
I have it.
Okay, good. All right, so my first clue to you would be to remove the mustache.
Okay, so what we're looking at here is we're looking at a cowboy. So it's obviously Hangman Adam Page. No, of course it's not Adam Page. But it is. It's a man in a vest.
A man
stars.
In his first gimmick. With his late 80s perm coif, firm Tom Selleck mustache.
Very Tom Selleck.
Wearing his leather, light brown leather vest and forearm bands with matching colors. Now, Damien, we did mention this man one or two times within this episode. He is relevant to Bullet Club, not currently, but in the past.
Is it Jeff Jarrett?
It's not Jeff Jarrett, but you are getting a little warmer.
I'm warmer. Am I warmer because of the NWA like Texas connection, or
I want to say he did come up through that, but I want to throw you off. We don't have to go that far off. My last clue to you would be that we mentioned a family member.
And this is a former member of Bullet Club? This is like somebody or just somebody that was related in some way to Bullet Club.
Correct. Bullet Club by proxy.
Bullet Club by proxy. So NWO?
Correct.
I mean, it kind of looks like Kevin Nash. It's not Kevin
You're
Nash.
You're so hot.
Am I? There's only other so many
Stephen
other
hot.
People. Is it Scott Hall?
It's Scotty Hall, baby.
That's Scott Hall?
That's Diamond Stud.
Boy, we just went from this to Cuba. We've been all over the place, haven't we, Scott?
Yeah, this is like the beginning. This is how, you know, Scott Hall walked into the wrestling business as like looking like this.
You know
it's certainly not clean cut, but it's certainly, you know, very astray from his 90s persona as a Cuban defector selling cocaine in the height of the drug era in Miami and becoming an outsider chewing on a toothpick and losing his Cuban accent.
Tell me a little bit about this iteration of Scott.
So not a lot of people know this, but like Scott Hall was a bouncer for a club and he got into an altercation with somebody, and he was completely in the right, by the way, where he pulled out a gun and he killed somebody.
Oh,
yeah.
Yep, well, that'll happen.
So if you want to understand Scott Hall's demons, I think you can. You can start there. You can cut the guy a little slack.
Okay.
Anywho, so yeah, this is when he got his start, much akin to where Kevin Nash was the great and powerful Oz, as we covered in our first episode. Scott Hall was getting his start in the ranks and coming up throughout the Southern scene. His first big shot was on Jim Crockett Promotions with World Championship Wrestling. He was known as Diamond Stud. And after this, he would eventually leave and he would go to the WWF, where you may know him as Razor Ramon, adopting his character from the legendary movie Scarface. He would play this role up until the infamous curtain call, to where him and Nash would go to WCW and start the Outsiders, or where you may know him as Scott Hall.
Of course.
If you kind of realize, though, when he does the infamous, like, you may not know why we're here, but you know who we are.
Yeah.
He kind of has, like, the Razor Ramon, like, tinge in his accent.
Oh, no, he totally does. If you want a war, got a war. And it's there. I'm also an idiot. I confused the Jarretts with the Funks. The Jarretts were in Tennessee, not Texas. That was the Funks. Also, shout out to Terry Funk, who apparently is battling some hip issues right now.
Get that man a ghost starter, man.
Get that man another hip.
Hey, Vince. Fucking open up the wallet. Give my man some money.
Help out Terry.
I was reading a story about how you gave $800,000 or something like that to Ric Flair so he can get a divorce. I think you could throw some shekels to old Funker's way.
Listen, Funker is his senior by a year, so... All right,
get the
that's
fuck out of here. Wait. Back up.
Terry
He's
Funk
older
is 70.
Than Vince.
Terry Funk is 76. Vince is 75.
Jesus Christ. The adage goes, like, when Terry Funk retired for the first time, Undertaker graduated high school. So
whatever you think you did first, Terry Funk did 15 times over.
Exactly. So, Damien, what are you listening to this week, pal?
All right, so I've been taking some steps back a little bit, right? So first album I want to give a shout out to is arguably the album that got me into punk rock as a young 13-year-old who had recently moved to Long Beach, excluding Dookie, which is probably the first punk rock album that I listened to. And that's The War on Errorism, NOFX's 2003 masterpiece. The first time that I heard The Separation of Church and State, the opening track, as a kid, I had recently shown up to Long Beach Middle School, and one of the kids I had just met, his name was Ethan, was wearing a NOFX shirt. He's wearing the War on Errorism shirt, which is George Bush painted as a clown. And I saw NOFX all over the place, and I was like, boy, I wonder if that's like a clothing brand. And Ethan caught me looking at his shirt, and he's like, hey, man, you know what NOFX is, right? And I was like, yeah, of course I do. And he went, oh, okay, cool. Yeah, I'd have to kick you out of Long Beach otherwise. But like, I was 13 and I just moved somewhere and was broken. So I was like, I don't want to get kicked. Don't kick me out, Mr. Mayor. So I went home and I LimeWired NOFX And a separation of church and state came up. And the first time that I heard that opening riff, I was fucking hooked. And it's just started a 15-year love affair ever since. It's a top-to-bottom incredible album full of great melodies, riffs, guitar work. For anyone that's a fan of skate punk, NOFX in general, or if you want like a catchy, fast punk album, Warren Arism is probably one of my favorites of all time. I've also been listening to a little bit. I'm going to give three albums today, and I'll keep it brief. Been listening to a smidge of new wave of British heavy metal, which me and Ryan shared a joint fond appreciation for, it being some of the first stuff that we listened to together. And also, as a little fun fact, whenever Ryan gets drunk, he likes to send me NWO BHM videos, which is always very exciting and fun. So this week, I'm going to give a special shout out to the seminal 1982 album by the legendary Judas Priest, Screaming for Vengeance. The Hellion Electric Eye, one of the best openers in metal of all time. Top to bottom, incredible songs. Bloodstone, Devil's Child, Pain and Pleasure, Screaming for Vengeance, Riding on the Wind, just fucking Priest really hitting all of their strides, and then followed up by Defenders of the Faith, Painkiller 8 years later. Just, can't say enough good things. I know Ryan can't say enough good things either.
As I alluded to, next year will be the 40th anniversary of both Screaming for Vengeance and Number of the Beast. So
let's hope, Papa. Let's hope.
Let's hope. That's all we can have, right?
And lastly, I'd like to give... I listen to a lot of power metal also, but we're not going to shout that out. Lastly, I want to give a shout out to an album that turned 20 the other day. Another one of the most important albums to me as a young punk rocker. Today's Empire is Tomorrow's Ashes by the legendary Canadian band Propagandhi. To this day, some of the hardest hitting political punk metal you'll ever hear. If you're looking for fucking crazy riffs and shit that just makes no sense, go listen to Propagandhi. Chris Hanna is one of the best.
In terms of political writings and,
man, you know, no one does it
incorporation
better
into their music, they make NOFX look like Good Charlotte.
Oh my God, absolutely. It's like dealing with Anti-Flag. It's no fucking comparison. Just top to bottom, excellent stuff. How about you, my friend?
You know, I decided to get weird this week, and I started to delve into a lot of post-metal and industrial and noise rock, and, you know, who to think better of than Swans.
I was thinking Swans. Yeah, I was just about to ask. Michael fucking Girard.
Yeah, so, I mean, ever since I got into the metal scene, and especially started listening to more, like, sludge and doom bands like Neurosis and Mastodon, people who had the same common interest within that music genre always tell me to listen to Swans. I'm like, all right. So, you know, I remember years ago you had my friend of the program, Moontooth guitarist, Nick Lee. When I first started hanging out with him, I said, Nick, give me a band to listen to. And he goes, dude, Swans, absolutely. Soundtracks of the Blind. And I listened to it, and it was too much for me. I couldn't fucking take it. One of the famous tracks on the album is a recording of a prisoner, and it starts to give like the daily like musings. Well, it's like, I know I'm fucked up, but do you know you're fucked up? And like, I threw up my fucking headphones at the time. But like, no, if you have an affinity for post metal and just like an experimental sound within metal, and not the same chug. Like, listen to Swans.
Yeah.
They are an easel within metal itself. And, you know, they came out with an album a couple years later, which was one of my favorites. Came out in about 2014, and that was To Be Kind. And that's also probably one of the best albums of the 2010s. And I can't talk it up enough. Go listen to them. They are on Spotify.
My Father Will Guide Me Up a Rope to the Sky is my personal favorite of theirs.
Oh, yeah. And that's about it.
Just Swans. Strictly Swans.
Strictly Swans this week. Obviously, you know, I have my usual suspects within my musical listenings. You know, I started finally drinking those single cut drinks, and those, oof, those things are, I did not know they were 14.2, the fucking Ricky Tikki Tavi rum punch there, whatever the fuck it is.
Did you start fucking just throwing dead and fish and just slamming your head into a wall?
No. I mean, the dead will always be they will always come up in one way or another. I'm not going to lie. And all my friends are like, God damn it, dude. Shut the fuck up.
Enough.
Now, when Papa drinks anything above 10%, you know,
yep.
Fucking Papa some power metal's coming on the scene. Blind Guardian. Oh, I showed Damien Blind Guardian.
Yes.
And, good fucking band, man. Good band.
And it made me start listening to like Helloween and like Gamma Ray and shit.
Yeah, so very, fun. Very, before we leave today, very important discussion. Helloween, controversial take or not, are they the best representation of power metal and new wave of British metal, even though they were like from Germany?
My personal hot take is that Helloween is better Iron Maiden. And I feel like you won't convince me otherwise. Maiden fucking rules. I love Maiden. I could tell you so much that I love about Maiden, but Helloween is better Maiden. So that's my hot take. And so with that, we wrap up here. I do want to give a special shout out to Lost Becomes. They will be dropping their new track Memory. What was that? February 14th, February 17th. I'll put a link up. It's dropping
February 17th.
It's dropping exclusive at Revolver Magazine. Yeah, you know, so as Ryan mentioned, it's the slow season for wrestling a little bit, you know. So we're gonna try to get a little funky in the next couple episodes. But hopefully everyone has enjoyed this little retrospective on the only club that matters, as WWE like to market it. Let's see what happens next, right? Where the fuck do we go from here? The sky is the limit, baby. Oh, also, actually, before I do the whole thing, you can probably expect a small but significant change to our name soon. We are still who we are, right? So I will not announce anything yet. I will make it official when it's time to be official.
We're getting the F out, so to speak.
Kind of, yes. We know that it's very difficult to find us because you don't know how many asterisks. You have to count on your hands how many letters are in fucking.
Is it seven? I don't know.
I'm going to go listen to Talk is Jericho instead. So you know, we'll be doing that soon. But, you know, whatever. We'll talk about it when it's time to talk about it. Anyway, for Ryan, for myself, this has been the most electrifying must-listen-to podcast in sports entertainment. This has been FFC. Supposed to be me rolling my mouth like when they do the B's for Bullet Club, but it's not what happened.
We're too white for that, man.
Yeah, it's another time.